Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking with our guest, Lee Crockett, author of Living on the Future Edge. And while there may be a lot of appealing things about the future edge that is coming, I can't help but think to worry about super technology being ubiquitous. It means that the good guys would have access to it, but it wouldn't be a monopoly. The bad guys could get it too. And I can only imagine what some super technology in the hands of certain crazies, the uses that it could be put to. We'll put that question to Lee Crockett and open up the phone lines with your questions right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us. We're talking with Lee Crockett, author of the new book, Living on the Future Edge. Lee, I don't know if you heard my tease there, but I was, and you know, you're describing tremendous disruption with this exponential kind of technological change that is just around the corner. Economic right. disruption, there'd be social disruption. You think about the haves and the have-nots. I mean, not everyone would be able to enjoy the benefits of this technology, not immediately anyway. We've got a nasty world out there. Zealotry is not going to go away. Jihads, religious and racial hatred, the haves and the have-nots fighting over resources. I worry about super technology, nanotechnology being ubiquitous and getting into the hands of crazies and radicals, if it's out there for everyone, what they could do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a risk. And you know, the point that we make in Living on the Future Edge is we talk about disruptive innovation and what that means. And, you know, an example of disruptive innovation would be, you know, in very quick terms, if you look at the music industry, what's happened in the music industry, that's something everybody's familiar with. You know, we went to digital music, the iPod came along, and now they own 70% of the MP3 player market, and they have over 90% of the digital music distribution market. It's completely and irrevocably altered that world. Same thing is happening with movies. You know, you used to go to movie theaters, then we used to go to Blockbuster. I mean, just a few weeks ago, Blockbuster announced they're shutting 970 stores and are on the verge of being delisted from the stock exchange because they're a company that you know, we don't need bricks and mortar video stores anymore. We download. So, you know, as each of these technologies comes in, they dramatically disrupt the industry that was there and leave it unrecognizable as far as how it looked before. It's just not the same anymore. And so if we're going to be dealing with this rapid amount of technological change, which we are, it's very obvious, what we're going to have is whatever kind of a future we want to have. I mean, it's the power is going to be there for us to design our future the way that we want to. It's not going to be limited by technology anymore. We're going to be able to create just about anything. And if that's the case, then what our argument is and what our statement continually is that we have to then teach our kids a set of skills that will allow them to be able to survive and to thrive in that kind of an environment, to make the right choices and to be able to adapt very, very quickly. And you know, and that's how we're going to prevent a lot of the bad stuff from happening. But it's absolutely a risk, just the same as it is with the technology that exists today. I mean, we have credit card fraud. We have all kinds of things that go on. We have people using this technology for bad, just the same as we have it using for good. And that's not going to go away. It's just going to be on a bigger scale. And I worry about it, too.
As you travel around and make this pitch to educators as they become familiar with your books, what's the reception? Because we look at schools today, the statistics are not exactly encouraging. It seems like so many schools are bogged down with no child behind, where all they do is teach to prepare for tests. Right. And I just wonder how professional educators, teachers, administrators respond to the message you're sending.
You know what, they get it, because the thing is that educators, you know, nobody got into education because of the money. They got into it because they love kids and because they want to make a difference. And they're a dedicated group of people and a hardworking group of people. The problem is they've been brought up in a culture of dependency, where if you think about it, teachers from the age of 5 have been in the school system, you know, first as students, then as university students, then as student teachers. And they've been taught a way of doing things, which is that you sit and you listen and you're told what to do and you do what you're told and you pass the test and you pass the grade. And they're being faced with something that's radically different, where they have to pose problems and they have to be the guide to learning as opposed to the facilitator. They're very open to it. They're always afraid of it, but I'll tell you, they embrace it when they have a chance, because our educators are beat down. You know, the mandates of what we call No Child Left Untested has left, you know, it's left our school system in ruins. I mean, it's a joke. It takes an estimated 21,000 hours to teach everything that's in the mandates of No Child Left Behind. Yet there's less than 9,000 hours of school available. So right from the beginning, it's a complete failure. There's not a chance that it's going to happen. So as a result, what they do is they go through the curriculum and they go, okay, what can be tested? What can they test on a national level? Can they teach? Can they test this? Can this be tested? No. Okay, it's out. Can this be tested? No, it's out. Can this be tested? Yeah, it's a fact. And then they try to drum those facts into kids. When we sit down and we show them what's going on, when we look at Dale's learning cone and we see that we remember 10% of what we read, but we remember 90% of what we apply in a real-world problem, and then teach another person, the argument for project and process-based learning becomes very, very clear. And what we're seeing is momentum happening where schools that are employing project and process-based learning are outperforming the schools that are still dealing with the drill and kill. And there is a huge paradigm shift coming in education, and certainly we're part of that process. But educators are very open to what we present to them, and they want it because they know they can't continue to do it the way it's always been done. The issue is more a system of education which is mired in dogma, not the educators themselves. They're the ones that want to make the change.
Good. Well, that's one paradigm shift I'm ready for then. We need that in education. We're going to the phones.
Absolutely.
First time caller, Bob in Pittsburgh. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Good morning, George and Lee. I have a question. This may sound really bizarre, but what do you think about the possibility that our world and maybe our universe is nothing more than a computer simulation created by, like an alien race that's a billion years older than us? Is that possible?
Well, you know, I think anything's possible, Bob, and that's certainly an interesting perspective, and that's kind of the Matrix point of view, where we're not really awake, but we're in an alternate reality. There's so many things you see when you look at the pyramids and their origin and different things about technologies that have happened at different parts of the world simultaneously, even though we were separated by continents and distances. You kind of wonder where some of this stuff could have come from, and you know, I certainly think that that's as much a possibility as any other possibility, but I'd kind of like to think that I'm actually here and present, but I think that there could be alien influence here that we're just not aware of, for sure.
There's another perspective on that, Bob. I mentioned it briefly in passing earlier in the program, a book written by a professor named Deutsch. It's called The Fabric of Reality, and he talks about once we master quantum computers, the sky is the limit. In fact, humans could become something akin to gods, create their own universes, create something like a matrix, and not just a computer simulation, but an actual universe. So you might want to check that book out sometime, and I think it'll blow your mind. We're going west of the Rockies, Richard in Spokane. Hi, Richard. How you doing?
Hi, pretty good today. George, I wanted to, I find this very interesting and fascinating indeed. I had a question you were talking about earlier about living forever in 15 years, and I was just kind of pondering the thought of how many people really want to live forever, and especially before we as people don't learn to stop killing each other and starting to help feed each other and take care of the planet. And also I wanted to ask, does anybody remember Alan Parsons' project, 1977 iRobot?
Yeah, we'll see if Jesse can dig some of that up. I think that raises some. That's a profound question, Lee, that you've had to dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing. I mean, this stuff is far in the future, and what does it mean? And these are great questions because, you know, it forces us to really think, what does it mean to be human, and what is our humanity to us? And I certainly wouldn't want the prospect of living forever. I enjoy the pressure that's put on me, knowing that time is precious and knowing that I have to make good decisions with that time. I think it changes who I am, and it drives me to a level to perform that I don't think that I would perform at if I felt my time was unlimited. You know, personally, because I know that time is limited, I really push myself to make the most of the time that I have, and I think that changes who we are as people. So, you know, I wonder how many people would actually choose that option if they had the ability to do so. I don't know that it makes us more or less, but I feel that perhaps it makes us less.
I suspect that everybody would tell you that they don't want to live forever, but if it came down to the minute that, okay, now's the time to die, they don't want to do that either. East of the Rockies. Thanks, Richard, for that call. East of the Rockies, Jeremy in Pittsburgh. Hi, Jeremy.
No, that was a great setup for my question, George.
Okay.
I'm curious to think, after reading some of the time wave zero ideas that Thomas McKenna, I think is his name.
Terrence McKenna?
Terrence McKenna. What do you think about perhaps that the technology you're talking about, the quantum computers, could, say, replace the heart and brain or, you know, create eternal life? Then that would explain the idea of no concept of time. Our perception of time would just simply change, you know, to no time if we could live forever.
Well, that's a little beyond me. Maybe Lee would like to tackle it.
Wow. Boy, thanks for that.
Yeah, sure. You're the guest. You have to answer stuff like that.
Yeah. The whole question of the space-time continuum is one that we haven't really answered yet. You know, is time space, is space time, and how do they relate to each other? I certainly think what you're talking about is a possibility, but I think that there's an element that we're missing between the two, and I think partly because we still think of those things as linear elements, and, you know, primarily we're linear thinkers. That's the issue we have with these global exponential trends, is that to imagine an exponential future is so difficult for us. We can think in linear terms, but to think exponentially is almost impossible for our brains to do. So I think that until we really are able to grasp what exponential really means, there's something that we're missing with space and time, because I think that they're different entities than linear, which is how we're thinking now.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to the top of our list of wildcard lines. Wildcard one, Steve in Highland Falls, New York. Hi, Steve.
Good evening, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wondered on a few different fronts. Number one, what happens to the basic human interaction, i.e. boys asking girls out, girls asking boys out, etc.? You know, high school dances, that whole front. I found myself in the last few years falling into a pattern of trying to meet people on the internet, etc., and trying to pull back from that because within myself, it didn't feel inherently right. Like, you know, technology versus the basic human interaction. And that was my first question. And secondly, what if you're left behind? Like, in other words, what if you resist and you don't want to upgrade, you don't have a computer, you don't have this or that, and you somehow are left behind in the technology race? And you say, you know, I don't have a computer, I don't want to do this or that. I have a basic understanding of technology and the interaction and the, you know, the current technology. But what happens if you don't want to do that? Are you going to be left behind, or are you going to become a minority? I mean, what happens there?
You know, Steve, these are great questions, and I want to answer your first one first. When you talk about humanity and human interaction, that is such an issue, and I think that, just as you pointed it out, and I mentioned it earlier, that there is something in our essence, something about humanity that is separate from what we can do with machines. There is something that just happens with interaction and touch, and we all crave connection. And honestly, if we think about it, that's what guys that are tweeting 100 times a day, you know, that's what's going on, is they're trying to connect. They're wanting to connect with other people, and maybe on a kind of an excessive and crazy way, but it's about human connection. And if we take the human interaction, the human connection out of all of these different technologies, I don't think they'd be anywhere near as popular, because what they're allowing to do is allowing people to connect in a way that they haven't been able to before. And that's the point, is that it's about human connection, and it's not about technology. And that's why I believe that we're not really headed to a place where we'll only exist as machines, because our humanity, our complete essence is not there when we do that. And so I don't think, in answer to your second question, that there's ever going to be a time where those people are left, where there's a group that are left behind, because there's always going to be a balance for us. And I think that our natural sense is to try and create that balance between the use of technology and the interaction with other people and other things. And I'm seeing more and more people pulling away from technology and using it for short, intense period of times to accomplish things that allow them more free time to do the things that really matter to them, to pursue passion. If you give people the opportunity to spend time on the internet or do something that they actually truly are passionate about, and give them a way to do it, they won't be choosing. They won't be choosing the technology route. I don't believe that at all.
You know, I see it's an interesting irony, I guess, in that we have, and I mentioned it earlier in the program, is that we have more capability for communication than ever before and seem more isolated. The technology can depersonalize human relationships. You go to your cell phone and you're on it all day. You're online all day. You're texting all day. You're communicating with other people, but not face-to-face, not touch-to-touch. I don't know that there's more of that, and I'm not sure that it's going to what the future holds in that regard. Seems like we're almost more isolated.
Yeah, there's more communication going on, but there's not more meaningful communication going on. Right. That's the point. We're craving that meaningful contact and that meaningful communication.
Exactly. Thanks for the call. We're going to Wildcard Line 2, Jim the truck. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Okay.
I'm out here in my truck. Gave you a little toot share in the love there.
Thanks, Jim.
You know what? It's amazing I could be in my tractor trailer and talk to you on the phone. I did a little show out of my truck where I was on a computer, and it was all hands-free. And I could talk to people not just like on a CB radio 10 miles away, but I could talk to people on the other side of the globe. And there's a place I used to go into a chat room where I know these people for years and years, but like you were just talking about, if you put all of us into a room, we wouldn't even know who's who. Yeah, I mean, I find that incredible that I can do that. It's a lot of people didn't like what I was doing, but a thing I wanted to ask you is something about Star Trek, and you were talking about how the flip phone by Motorola was made that simulated or copied the Star Trek thing. So, in the movie Star Trek, Captain Kirk, there was a transporter malfunction, and they were mourning his death. And as they were walking around in the ship, he would appear in different areas of the ship, like floating around in his spacesuit. Remember that one?
Right. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, remember that? And then they were like, they thought they were having hallucinations. But what he was doing was phasing in and out of different universes. So what do you think about that? Is that possible?
George, is that for you or for me?
That's for you.
No, that's for me. Okay. Sure, I think that's possible. I mean, this comes back to the space-time continuum that we talked about earlier, and us not really truly understanding what it is, and being in phase, being able to be seen in one place or another, depending on on our alignment with that particular space and time continuum. Yeah, certainly, I think that's possible. And I think that's even probable. That might be some of how we unlock the keys to travel into distant places. Is true that very. That very concept. I think that's a great example, Jim, of a kind of a possible future.
You know, in our discussion of the UFO topic, which comes up now and then on this program, of course, we mentioned last week in the discussion about Jacques Vallée, something that Vallée had said, that if these visitors, whatever they're doing, wherever they're from, if they truly can control space-time and manipulate space-time, they can be from anywhere, not necessarily extraterrestrial, interdimensional. They're from the future. They're from the past. I mean, the possibilities are endless if you can control the kind of technology that can bend space-time, control gravity, for example. So we're right there with you, Jim the truck, and hope you are safe out there on the roads. Thanks for the call. Wildcard Line, Jocelyn in Wisconsin. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi. First of all, I'm calling to make a comment. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, George, for caring so much about another species besides just ourselves, you know, the horses and all that horrible stuff. It's obvious that they are in the pockets of the ranchers.
Hey, but Jocelyn, also, I'm sorry for taking your call right before the break. Can you hang on? We'll get to your question after the break.
Sure.
Okay, you stay right there. We'll be continuing our conversation with Lee Crockett, author of Living on the Future Edge, after this on Coast to Coast AM. Our conversation with Lee Crockett, author of the book Living on the Future Edge. We're speculating about the world of the future, and I don't mean the distant future. I mean the near future, the rapid pace of technological change and what it might mean to us. We had a call from Jocelyn in Wisconsin. Jocelyn, you hung up on us. You shouldn't supposed to hang on the line. Why don't you call back and try to get through, and we'll try to get your question on the line. In the meantime, we'll be going back to the phones right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for hanging with us, everyone. Enjoying a conversation with Lee Crockett, author of Living on the Future Edge. Going back to the phone, Spencer in Wisconsin on the Wild Card line. Hi, Spencer. Hello?
Hey.
What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. How you doing? Nothing. I'm 20 years old, so I'm still pretty young. So kind of going back to where Lee started at the beginning of the show with the generation that grew up with the exponential growth happening in computing and everything. I was kind of made the connection between that and ADD and ADHD children, and how the older generation of teachers and psychiatrists are throwing this at the kids, like, well, no, this is wrong with you because you can't pay attention. Well, I can picture, like, even me when I was in high school not too long ago, like them writing on the chalkboard or on the whiteboard and just everything being so slow and so like you just couldn't pay attention to it. So I think that is probably, or my theory on why this whole epidemic of this outbreak of ADD and ADHD is because of the exponential growth of computing, because they just can't pay attention to that slow pace of learning, if you know what I mean.
I think that's a pretty good point. What do you think?
Spencer, I completely agree with you, actually, both in understanding that, actually, in understanding the digital generation, we wrote about a half a chapter on this very subject, because outside of Canada, the United States, and a little bit in Great Britain and New Zealand, Australia, there are almost no reported cases of ADD, ADHD. It just doesn't exist. It's become the brain syndrome of this generation, and personally, I think it's about selling drugs more than anything else. You know, kids have no problem concentrating, and I know that, Spencer, you'd be a perfect example of this. Kids have no problem concentrating for something that interests them. For kids to spend 18, 20 hours straight working on a video game to get to that next level because it interests them, that's not an issue. For them to sit online and learn how to play the guitar by watching videos and practicing, they can do that for hours. For doing a mashup, not a problem, and they'll spend hours doing a mashup. But it's for things that interest them, things that don't interest them. Same with memorization. You know, kids can instantaneously give you the lyrics of 1,000 songs. It's because it's stuff that they see as relevant, and it's stuff that they see as engaging. And school is not seen as either of those. So I completely agree with you. ADD and ADHD, although there are legitimate cases, it's an excuse for anybody that can't pay attention, stick Ritalin in them and just say that they've got a problem, when the problem really is, an educational system that is not engaging students the way that it should.
Excellent call. Excellent point, Spencer. Jocelyn is back on our wild card line. Hi, Jocelyn. Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Thanks for calling back.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say that even with the technology that I'm 65 years old, and I don't have a computer. I don't understand the need. I just don't get it. But I don't think that we have the moral or ethical fabric to handle. Our brains are not even caught up to the technology, really. That's why I look at people and I see what goes on around the world there's corruption everywhere. I know I may sound like a cynic, but that's just the way it is. I used to think otherwise, but the longer I live, I see things worse, you know. And if you look back on human history, we're not much different. When that movie 2001 came out, when the beginning of it, when they show the caveman throwing up the bone and it turns into the spaceship, I mean, that's the only difference we have, like weaponry, is... it's just, I don't see really too much good. It's good for medical, to help people, instead of giving you an exploratory, surgically, they can give you an MRI. That kind of thing is good. But and it keeps changing all the time, and it fills up the landfills. I just, because of the change, and they just throw away, and they rush, literally just rush to get the newest iPad or whatever the heck it is, I just don't get it.
Well, Jocelyn, I think that's an important, it's an important point, and we've sort of been nibbling around the edges of it tonight about the the possibility that humans are incapable of handling the great pace of the change that's coming. Maybe in a maturity standpoint, that you know, the great technological changes that are coming, the great powers that will accompany these changes, that we're just not mature enough, that we haven't changed all that much, as she mentioned, from the cavemen. What do you think, Lee?
Well, you know, Jocelyn brings up some really interesting points there, and one that she brought up is she was wondering about what good is there possibly in this, you know, and I'll give you something that I see as something that's really beneficial from everything that's going on. We are approaching a time where anyone that has an idea is able to present that idea. We can write that book. We can promote it ourselves. We can self-publish. We can create a blog. We can communicate our ideas. And you know, as opposed to dealing with mass media, where so much of it is, if it bleeds, it leads. You're only going to hear the story that's on the wire that everybody else is going to be playing. What this technology is allowing us to do is to actually communicate honestly and openly on a one-to-one basis, and that makes control so much more difficult. So, you know, I certainly see that there is some positive benefits to this as far as an honesty and a transparency in what's going on in communication. Do I think that we're mature enough to handle it? I think that maturity is constantly something that we need to work on, and you know, we constantly need to deal with this balance issue and respect, being able to look at this technology and ask ourselves these hard questions. Is this a good idea? I mentioned this earlier, you know, to be able to step back with respect and look at it and say, is this necessary, and do I need to be doing this? I think that we're certainly mature enough if we choose to be, but I think that too often we get caught up in what's the latest and greatest and not really thinking about the bigger issues.
Well put. Thanks for the call, Jocelyn. Appreciate it. On our wildcard line, we have Marcia, who's in LA. She's the author of The Dummies Guide to the Internet. Marcia, how you doing?
Well, actually, author of eBay for Dummies and about 25 other books. But before I tell you that, I have to tell you what Jocelyn just said. I started a series for seniors, Twitter and Facebook for seniors for dummies, eBay for seniors for dummies. There is so much out there for people who are over 50 who can learn these technologies, and Facebook is an incredible way for them to grow their social circles. You know, so many older people get isolated, and by being online, it's a miracle. I've seen people get together after many years, and as I said, I've been writing since 1998, my first book, eBay for Dummies. I have about 25 books out that are based on the internet, e-commerce, things like that. And I see people earning a living all the time on the internet. But the interesting part, Nicholas, and I love your book. I've read it. It's wonderful.
No, this is Lee. We're talking to Lee Crockett. Nicholas was on earlier.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. But the thing was that people really need to get their words in short bites. When I write my books, I give all the information. You want a topic, it's in one space. And they don't have to jump around and read chapter and go to this and go to that. And I think the writing for instruction for adults needs to be in short bites in our new way of reading, because the way people read now is different. I don't think it's dumbed down. I think it's actually better. You know, if people want to read deeper, they can. But when you're instructing people through books these days, I think it's really important to give them just the facts and then to flesh it out so it becomes more interesting. I think it's a different type of writing than we used to do.
Yeah, well, Marshall, we kind of talked about that with Nick Carr when he was on earlier, the internet has sort of trained us to write and read and comprehend in short, bite-sized pieces. And his thesis was that it is the result of that. It's sort of rewired our brains and has interfered with our ability to think deeply. And Lee, I want to get your take on that. Do you agree?
Well, you know, I have kind of a different point of view on it. I mean, certainly the rewiring is happening. There's no doubt about that, and there's all kinds of documented evidence. We write about it in Understanding the Digital Generation. Nick writes about it in The Shallows. Certainly that is happening. Has it changed our ability to handle the longer-term stuff? No, I don't think so, personally. It just makes it more challenging for us to do so because it's not as interesting. It's not as fun for us. You know, but when we talk about the styles of reading, you know, it's not just the internet, because this has actually been going on for a long time, George. If you think about it, like if you ask someone if they read the newspaper, You know, somebody will tell you, yes, I read the newspaper. And I will say, okay, well, so you start at the very first word on the first page and you read to the very last word on the last page. Well, no, I don't do it like that. You know, there's a system. There's a way that we do this. We look at the pictures first, and then we look at the headlines. And then if the headline interests us, we may look at the subheadlines. And then we may scan for information throughout the particular article. And when we find something that we're interested in, then we might zero in, and then we might actually read that. But very few people, if you really ask them, actually read the newspaper. So, you know, this style of scanning and skimming and searching for information and searching for relevance through stuff has been going on a long time, and it's not just an internet fad. It's been happening a very long time, ever since there's been newspapers, which is over 100 years.
I guess it's comparable to channel surfing on television too.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call, Marsha. Appreciate it. East of the Rockies, Kenneth in Pittsburgh. Good morning, Kenneth.
Yes, sir. I was wondering about the nanotechnology. If you injected something into your system that did seek out disease, wouldn't that weaken the natural immune system? And wouldn't it be completely annihilated by, like, a EMP pulse? I'll take this offline.
Thanks for the call, Kenneth. Lee?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, Kenneth. And not being a doctor, I don't have the answers to it. But my theory is that that the kind of stuff they're talking about doing with nanotechnology is eliminating diseases and things that the immune system is unable to handle at this point in time. Things that are chronic, removing cancer cells, removing AIDS cells, things that the body is unable to defend itself against. That's the kind of stuff that they're talking about dealing with nanotechnology. Not the common stuff that actually builds our immune system. And you're absolutely right. Interaction with things does increase our immunity to all kinds of different things. That's why it's so important when we're young that we have exposure to all that stuff and don't necessarily live in a germ-free environment. But no, they're talking with nanotechnology more about targeting things that are incurable and things that the body can't fight off with its own immune system.
Okay, thanks for the call, Kenneth. West of the Rockies, Owen in California. Good morning, Owen.
Hi, George. It's good to talk to you. Hi, Lee. Listen, I'm going to make this really quick. I'm an anthropologist. 6 to 10,000 years ago, we jumped. I don't believe in long evolutionary change. What we're doing, I believe, now is jumping again. I believe that our intellect and everything that has to do with technology is bringing us to that point, and how we look at it is going to make the difference in our lives. And it's astounding to me. My colleagues and I know about the jump, but I think this is going to be a jump. And I also think that a lot of the spirituality around 2012, et cetera, which I'm not going to get into, has a lot to do with what's happening now in our society. And we do have to pay attention on what we do with this. But I think it's going to happen. I think we're going forward, and I think we're going to do this jump. And everything else in the past will be the past.
Well, that's an interesting point. I guess there's no question where there's a jump. We're already in the middle of it, although as you write in your book, Lee, it's hard to see that you're in a paradigm when you're in it. But I guess there's no question that we're in one and it's changing.
No, absolutely. That's for sure. We're in the middle of it, and it is changing, and it's changing very, very quickly. And that's why it's so important that we examine, you know, our moral and ethical compass, and that we develop those skills to be able to look at this stuff critically and make good decisions with it. Because, you know, as I said, with disruptive innovation, we can have whatever kind of a future we want to have. The technology is there for us to do that now, and we need to make good choices with it, and that is based on our own values for sure.
First time caller, Wayne in Houston. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning. I just wanted to find out your ideas on being able to use technology in the future to cure dementia or Alzheimer's or people with different brain problems.
Right, you know, that actually in Nick's book, In the Shallows, he talks about this as well. There's a lot of stuff going on with neuroplasticity, and a lot that we're learning about the brain and how the brain is wired, and how actually we create some of our diseases by focusing on them, particularly with some of our compulsions and so forth, or OCDs. And I think that there is certainly possibilities for that if we look at changing what the stimulus is to the brain. I certainly think that in the future we're probably going to be able to deal with this stuff. The brain is still such a largely unmapped area for us, even though we've made so many incredible advances in the last 5 to 10 years in our understanding of it. We still don't fully comprehend everything that's going on. And I think that yes, in the future, we certainly will be able to deal with these brain disorders through technology.
We're all crossing our fingers there, Wayne. Thanks for the call. On the wildcard line, Ray is calling from Gainesville, Florida.
Good evening, Wayne and George. Listen, that was a movie years ago. And first off, I agree with that lady that I forget what her name is, that didn't like the technology. Was 65, I'm 63. There was a movie where they integrated machines and man together, and they all ended up looking like Hollywood movie stars. And, of course, in the movie, it didn't take into account the millions and millions of people in the third world that could not afford to be merged into a machine, you know, couldn't afford the medical process. And my question is, in the future, would people who are like, you know, there's people that are organic, that will not eat anything that's not organic, and there are people like the Amish that will not have any kind of modern conveniences in their house. In the future, would it be necessary, would it be mandatory that you're hooked up to the Internet and are on a high-tech, like the Social Security card is kind of like, you know, you can't buy or sell unless you have the number? Would that be the case, or would we be allowed to? Because, like, I'm in the last century. I don't even have a high-tech anything. I have a block on internet and you know, what do you call it, writing on the phone. I don't, if I could, I'd have a dial or a rotary dial on my cell phone. I don't do any of it, you know. So what my question is, in the future, would people be allowed to be like the Amish, or would they have to go on the internet?
Well, that's an interesting possibility, whether you could be a Luddite by choice or something like that, whether you could live off the grid. And I would guess, you know, at least as long as America is something of a free country, that would be a possibility. Lee, have you thought it out that far?
You know, I was thinking along those exact same lines, George. You know, that's one of the benefits of living in a free country is being able to make those decisions to do whatever you want, however crazy that may seem to other people. And I don't think that in the future it's going to be mandated by any stretch of the means. But you know that's why we live where we live, right?
Yeah, east of the Rockies, Tom in Indiana. Try to get one more call in. Better make it quick though.
Yes. Several years ago, there was a movie about one of these computers that decided to take over, hooked up with national security from the different. Is there any thought of putting any safeties on these computers to prevent this from ever happening?
Good question. I'm yes or no, Lee?
yes. I would say yes, there is.
Sorry we didn't have enough time to finish that. Lee Crockett, author of Living on the Future Edge, sure is an interesting book, and there is some optimistic stuff in there, even though I seem to have concentrated on the pessimistic stuff. Best of luck to you and your book, and hope you'll come back and see us sometime.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me, George.
Thanks also to Nick Carr, author of The Shallows. I'll be back next month, everyone. Have a good time in between. Hope you enjoy the rest of your summer. Good night.